Snetter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA1977 on Twitter.
Nailer Snetter, just talking to teachers.
Hello and welcome to Nailer's Natter, and this week I am joined by Canadian educator Michael Swegstra to talk about his John Catt publication, A Sage on the Stage, Common Sense Reflections on Teaching and Learning. Michael Swegstra is a Canadian public high school teacher and author, and he currently teaches social studies. Michael received his Bachelor of Education, Post-Baccalaureate Certificate in Education, and Master of Education degrees. He also holds a Master of Arts in Theological Studies from Liberty University. As an educator, Michael is a strong proponent of raising academic standards, holding schools accountable for their results, and expanding the educational options available to parents. His columns promoting common sense education reforms have been published in major Canadian newspapers, including the National Post, The Globe, and The Mail. Michael is also a frequent guest on radio and television stations across the country. And his first book, What's Wrong with Our Schools and How We Can Fix Them, was published in 2010. In the podcast pedagogy section this week, I am reading the Research Ed Guide to the Curriculum, edited by Claire Seeley, and of course the series editor Tom Bennett. And of course, listeners will know, but for those of you that don't, Research Ed is an educator-led organisation with the goal of bridging the gap between research and practice. And this accessible and punchy series, overseen by founder Tom Bennett, tackles the most important topics in education with a range of experienced contributors exploring the latest evidence of research and how it can apply in a variety of classroom settings. So in the edition that I'm looking at, Claire Seeley explores how schools can get the most out of a rich curriculum, and she has contributions from a wide range of writers, including previous guest on Nailer's Natter, that's Neil Almond, Doug Lamov, and Christine Council, Professor Michael Young, and Ruth Ashby. And for listeners' benefit, Claire Seeley is the head of curriculum and standards for the states of Guernsey. She has 30 years of experience as a primary school teacher, with 22 of them as head, and runs a very popular primary timary blog. And Tom Bennett is, of course, the founder of Research Ed. So without further ado, let's get into my conversation with Michael Swegstra. Okay, so hello, Michael, and welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Excellent. So we're going to start, as we always do, with a brief introduction to your career to this point. But before we do that, just to say that the conversation is around your John Catt publication, which is A Sage on the Stage, has Common Sense Reflections on Teaching and Learning. So that's what we're going to be making our discussion is going to be mainly focused on. So if you could just start, as we said, by giving us a little brief introduction and a little brief history of your career to this point.
Well, sure. I've been a teacher for about 20 years, and I decided to become a teacher after I had my first year of university. I was actually on a different path. I was thinking about going into science, and I actually ended up deciding that, no, actually, I'd like to be a teacher. I like taking complex ideas and making them simple, and I felt that was something that I could do. And so I transferred into the Faculty of Education and took my education degree. I can't say that I enjoyed my education courses very much. Even back then, there was a lot that I learned in the Faculty of Education that I remember looking into and going, I don't think the evidence actually supports this. But I certainly enjoyed my subject area courses. So I finished my Bachelor of Education degree, and then I started teaching at the grade 5 level, and did that for 7 years. And then within the same school that I'm in, because it's a grade 5 to 12 school, I switched over to high school. And then for the last 13 years, I've been teaching high school social studies courses, so areas such as history, ethics, world religions, and so on. And so that's in a nutshell what my teaching career has been. I've been doing writing on education policy throughout most of that time, and so I've certainly enjoyed doing that. And I find being in the classroom certainly helps me keep very much grounded in terms of the things that I write about.
Absolutely, and that's a theme that we visit quite a lot on the podcast here. In terms of, you know, we have a tagline which is talking to teachers. So obviously you're very much in the classroom and obviously talking about that in your book. Right, if we get into chapter one, Michael, if that's okay, and it's something that will definitely chime with listeners here in the UK and possibly listeners elsewhere as well. Chapter one is Foolish Educational Fads. So it's a fantastic read, and like I said, one that will chime with many of our listeners. And, you know, thanks to the research and evidence-based movement in the UK and, you know, things like ResearchEd, for example, we've seen a lot of these debunked. But could you outline some of the educational fads and gimmicks and tell us why education fads do teachers and kids no favours?
Well, one of the most pervasive ones, and I'm sure you've talked about in your program before, is the idea of individual learning styles. The idea that some people are visual learners, some are auditory learners, some are tactile kinesthetic learners, and that teachers need to teach according to each student's individual learning style. This fad, there is no evidence for it. In fact, you can go to the website of the American Psychological Association and just type in learning styles, and up will come articles from the APA debunking learning styles. It's really easy to find, but there's no evidence for it, and yet it just amazes me that fad just never goes away. I see it in education documents from governments. I see it in faculties of education where teachers are trained. I see it in some of the popularized literature, so it just never seems to go away. And the problem with that fad is that if you actually take it literally, you're burning teachers out because they're having to try to find everyone's so-called learning style and then try to adapt their teaching accordingly, when really the more efficient thing and the more logical thing is to do what Dr. Daniel Willingham says and make sure that you're adapting your teaching to best fit the content that you're teaching. So some topics are best suited for pictures. Some topics are best suited for auditory, and some topics are best suited for working hands-on with models. And for a lot of topics, you should do all three. But you do it with everyone. You don't take students and isolate them into different groups and put them with this artificial learning style. You use a variety of strategies with all students. And so that is that's one of the fads that's out there, and it just never seems to go away.
No, completely. And for listeners' benefit, I was tagged rather foolishly in a Twitter thread only yesterday, trying to sort of garner my support for the post about learning styles. Now, working in we have research schools over here in the UK attached to varying degrees of schools, so it's, you know, secondary schools, primary schools, whatever it might be. And one of our biggest jobs was to go around and kind of talk about evidence-based practice. And it's the one that will not die, as you rightly say. It's still there. And, you know, people latched onto this straight away on this Twitter thread. And I was very fortunate that Paul Kirshner, who I've spoken to recently on the podcast, kind of weighed in. And he has much more gravitas on and obviously knowledge on these areas. So people obviously listen to Paul. But, yeah, it's still a battle that we're very much facing over here. So that's similar for you, is it?
Yeah, absolutely. It seems to be a battle everywhere. And the reason why that fad has so much staying power, because I write about in the book about just some obviously dumb fads that the general public will never buy into, and those ones have trouble getting traction. But the learning styles one, to a lot of people, it intuitively makes sense because it seems that, yeah, you know, so I like looking at pictures, or I like hearing things, and so it feeds into this false narrative. And so people intuitively think that it's true, when really what they're doing is they're just thinking about particular times where, yeah, you know, I really learned well in this particular case, but it has nothing to do with your learning style. It has everything to do with, you know, for that particular thing you were looking at, the way you learned it happened to be the most efficient way to do it, and that sticks out in your memory because that was just happened to be good teaching, a good time of learning. And so that is one of the reasons why that fad never goes away, is because the public is largely bought into it.
Yeah, and I mean, you've talked about mandatory e-learning is another fad as well. So you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, this has been it's definitely a timely one considering the COVID-19 pandemic that's been going on. But e-learning, of course, is where students are instead of being in class are learning by distance, learning online, and I'm not opposed to that. When it's done intentionally and when it's done voluntarily. I mean, distance learning is here to stay, particularly at the post-secondary level, obviously. But the problem is you have some places, such as in the province of Ontario, Canada, where the government is trying to mandate e-learning, that all high school students need to do, for example, two courses through e-learning. Even though those courses are offered in their high school and they can take it in regular class with a teacher, the government has this misguided idea that students need to learn how to do this type of learning, so we're going to require them to do these courses online. The problem with that is that for the vast majority of students, and particularly the younger you go, the more important it is that they have direct in-person contact with the teacher. Because e-learning, you need to be extremely self-disciplined, motivated, not be given to procrastination. That doesn't describe most high school students, and that is why forcing high school students to do e-learning is a big mistake. But unfortunately, it's all about being trendy in many cases, and this misguided idea that, you know, it's all about technology. We've got to move further into the 21st century. And I just think that's a huge mistake, because there's no evidence at all that forcing students to do e-learning instead of regular classroom learning is going to benefit them in any way at all.
No, absolutely. And you mentioned that it's timely, and I don't know what the situation is where you are, but we are still fairly kind of anchored in home learning at the moment. So as we speak on Czechs Watch, the 13th of June, we are preparing to return some students or some more students to school. I work in a secondary school, but at the moment I'm trying to juggle that with home learning and homeschooling for my children as well. And as you rightly say, you know, mandating them to do sort of e-learning, well, you know, the older boy who's in the last year of primary school, you know, he's fairly self-reliant and might get on with that, but we'll drift into Fortnite and Minecraft and any other type of game given half a chance. But the, you know, my daughter who's in year two, you know, trying to ask her to sit at a computer and get anything from that, she really needs the kind of direct instruction of the teacher.
Well, absolutely, those things are absolutely essential. And you know, it's funny because that it's a similar situation in Canada, that schools are for the most part still largely shut down here, although there's certain areas students are returning, at least in a partial sense. But we've basically engaged in a grand experiment in, you know, making everyone do e-learning, and it works for some, but for the vast majority of students, this is a decidedly inferior way in which to learn. I like the term that a lot of teachers have been using, that this is emergency remote teaching that we're doing right now. It's an emergency measure. Yes, it can work in a rudimentary sense, but anyone who had sort of the idea that, you know, we're going to eventually be replacing teachers with computers and we're just going to have everyone sitting at home online doing stuff and that's the way of the future, anyone who thought that before, who's got kids at home, should just probably realizing by now, no, that's not the way of the future. The way of the future is direct instruction from teachers in school, in regular classes.
Absolutely. So moving into chapter two, if we can, and chapter two is entitled Raising Academic Standards. So I'm aware this is a big question, but you talk about raising academic standards and why should schools focus on the essentials? And I suppose, what are those essentials?
Well, I would say that the essentials are three key things. And I take these from a well-known education writer and commentator, Mike Schmoker, because I think he sums it up very well. And I argue that the three essentials are: you need a reasonably coherent curriculum. In other words, you need to have a clear focus on knowledge and have rich content within the curriculum, because content is key to learning. And so you need that. You need solid curriculum. You need sound lessons. And by that, I largely mean direct instruction. Like, basically, you need, you know, you have clear objectives. The teacher teaches the lesson. Students are paying attention, they learn, they get time to practice, the teacher gives feedback and corrects errors, and you move on. And then the third key thing is you need purposeful reading and writing in every discipline. You need to have students engaging in actual reading and writing, and it actually has purpose behind it. Those are the essentials. And you'll notice that those things do not include technology. They do not include many of the fads that are out there. They do not include defronting the classroom and all these other sorts of things that people like to promote. But it's relatively simple things that if we make sure that we have a content-rich, a coherent curriculum, we have good sound lessons in the classroom and good purposeful reading and writing, you focus on those three things, we get some really good learning. We raise academic standards. And those things I'm talking about, we're not talking about large sums of money here that we need. We're talking about using what we have more efficiently and focusing better. And so I really think that those are some of the key things in terms of raising academic standards.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. And on that similar theme, if you move into to chapter three and you talk about, and it's a really good title for a chapter, you know, that tests are good for students. So just tell us exactly why do you think that tests are good for students?
Well, tests are good for students because they play a key role in identifying what students have learned and what they have not learned. And I would argue that tests, they provide valuable information. I mean, we wouldn't let someone start, get the driver's license if they hadn't actually done a driving test. I mean, you need that important information. You wouldn't want an optometrist to give you a new prescription for your glasses if you hadn't actually done an eye exam, if you actually hadn't done some sort of standardized eye test to find out how well you're able to see. And so you take a subject like math, and we want to know, are students able to multiply and divide and do these things? Well, the best way to find out is you give them a test. You give them pencil and paper, you give them some questions, and then you find out very quickly if they're able to do it. If we want to find out if they know the history of a certain thing or if they understand some scientific concept, we need to have a test. Now, I know that there are those who would argue that the tests, they're stressful and they're not authentic. I mean, I've heard all these phrases, but of course there is some stress with tests, but stress is a normal part of life. There's nothing wrong with a healthy amount, a reasonable amount of stress that causes you to prepare, to think, to study, to focus, and those are all good things for students. It's good for students to be in the habit of knowing that that they need to prepare for things, and they need to focus, and they need to study, because that is what life is like. And so, for many reasons, I would suggest that tests are good for students.
Yeah, absolutely. And you follow it up to talk about standardized testing, and you outline really well the arguments and the challenges against standardized tests, and then you argue for the need for standardized testing. So just want to unpick those arguments for us.
Yeah, standardized testing, just to define it for everyone, I mean, standardized test is a test that is designed, that is standardized in the sense that it's the same for everyone, that it is administered at a certain time, and then is centrally marked. So, for example, when you have like sort of government tests for all students at a certain grade level, they all write it on a certain day, and then it's marked by education officials, not by the regular classroom teacher. So that way, you have more objectivity in the results. Obviously there are a lot of arguments that are made against standardized testing, and some of them have merit because you can take standardized testing to an extreme. And we have to be careful on this. And like we've seen this in the United States, where you have standardized tests that are far too narrow, that zero in only on very narrowly defined literacy and numeracy skills. Or what schools do is they drop the content in science and social studies and replace it with test practice and drills. That is not the type of standardized testing I'm interested in. It is not helpful. We need more content, not less. So proper standardized testing is where you have tests that are directly correlated to the curriculum that you're teaching. And so in a subject like English language arts, where students are learning English, a standardized test would, among other things, would include questions about the assigned books that students have read and, the authors and such. And so that way, students, we're finding out, have teachers covered the curriculum? Have they actually covered the content? Do students know the content? And standardized tests are they're important information, because if you don't have them, it's very hard to determine whether or not students have actually learned the curriculum. I know that teachers can do their own tests, and I believe in teachers doing their own tests. I'm not at all in favor of a standardized test making up 100% of the mark or anything remotely like that. I do want teachers to have a lot of flexibility in how we do things, but I still want to have some kind of test at the end to ensure that students have learned what they're supposed to learn. The alternative is that if you don't have standardized testing, and we see this in a lot of jurisdictions, is that governments replace it with all these other kind of checklists that teachers need to fill out, and more in-classroom observations where the principal has to come in and watch us while we're teaching and make sure we're covering these things. You know, those things are far more destructive to teacher autonomy and professional judgment than a test at the end of the course or at the end of the year that just simply helps find out whether students have learned the things they're supposed to learn. I would much rather have, you know, a standardized test that students write at the end than have endless monitoring throughout the process to try to make up for the fact that we're not assessing students at the end properly.
No, definitely. And in terms of the content knowledge that you mentioned there, that leads us nicely into chapter four. Now, I absolutely love the introduction to this chapter, Michael, when you start to talk about Tolkien and we start to talk about Lord of the Rings, and you explain how Tolkien showed a tremendous amount of creativity, but even more importantly, content knowledge in his Lord of the Rings trilogy. So kind of the big question is, can you tell listeners why you think that content knowledge is so important?
Well, it's important because it's absolutely key to learning. And I started the chapter by talking about J.R.R. Tolkien because I know that almost everyone knows who he is. And like, his books are incredible. When you look at the depth of when he describes Middle Earth, and he's basically created this whole new world and the intricacies of it and how all these fit together, it's amazing. And so often what we do is we look at that and go, wow, is he ever creative? And so we need to, that's what we want our students to be like. So let's teach them to be creative. Let's remove the, you know, this boring old, you know, bunch of facts that we expect students to memorize, and let's help them be creative like J.R.R. Tolkien. And the problem with that is that Tolkien, yes, he was creative, but wow, did he ever have content knowledge? He had a solid university education in philology. That's the study of languages. He knew Old English literature. He knew Norse mythologies. And all those things, that gave him the base that he needed in which to be creative. And so what content knowledge does is it gives you the ability to actually think critically and to do these things. I argue that content knowledge, you know, it's critical for several key reasons. It's critical because it makes critical thinking possible. You can't think critically about something you know nothing about. You know, you pick any controversial topic out there nowadays, and if you don't have a reasonable amount of background knowledge in whatever that topic is, you can't think critically about it. And so if we want students to be critical thinkers, they need to know a lot of things in their brain. It's not enough to say that, well, they could just go Google it. If you just go Google something and you know nothing about it, you've got a pretty high chance you're going to be led on a rabbit trail and you're going to get a whole lot of false information. Content knowledge is also essential for learning how to read. You know, the debate over how do students learn how to read, it often gets boiled down to the old phonics versus whole language debate. And that's only half the equation. And for the record, I'm pro-phonics. The evidence is pretty clear on that one. But you're only halfway there if you recognize that phonics is better than whole language, because the other half is reading comprehension. Can students understand what they read? And if you don't know anything about the topic of the article that you're reading, you will not be able to understand it, even if you're able to sound out every word and every letter that's there in front of you. When I used to teach grade 5, I remember doing something called running records with students where you get them to read an article and then you mark down how many mistakes they make when reading it and then ask them some comprehension questions. And I noticed very quickly that when I was giving them an article about hockey or baseball or something of that sort, generally speaking, students were doing pretty well in the comprehension questions. But then I'd give them an article at the same official reading level about Dr. Norman Bethune, who's this Canadian doctor that went to China in the 1930s and, you know, provided medical service out there. And the students bombed the comprehension questions, even though it was the same reading level. And the answer is pretty clear. It's because they didn't have a clue who Norman Bethune was, and they didn't know anything about China in the 1930s or any of the context at that time. And it again shows, and there's research that backs this up that's pretty overwhelming, that students can read things if they have background knowledge about it. In fact, you can read things at a more advanced level if you have background knowledge about the topic, and that is actually a better predictor of your reading comprehension than just simple ability to say the words that happen to be in front of you. And so content knowledge is just absolutely vital. It really is key to learning.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a similar example from an exam over here where students were asked about a baseball game. Now, I'm aware that obviously baseball is a lot bigger. Certainly in America, I'm ashamed to say, Michael, I don't know about Canada. But it's not extremely big over here. So in terms of the background knowledge and the content knowledge of that sport in particular, students found it really hard to access. So absolutely right. Do you mind if I just read something that, I absolutely love this chapter and I love the last paragraph. So just for listeners' benefit, because I think that this is something that you could take and frame and put up in an office somewhere. So I'm just going to read this to you. It says, "Teachers are not interchangeable factory widgets who can be replaced at the drop of a hat. Just as pilots are not merely lead flyers, teachers are much more than lead learners. They are, in fact, professionals who possess specialised knowledge and skills. Thus, teacher expertise really does matter. It benefits no one when education gurus downplay teacher expertise by saying that knowledge and skills do not matter." And, you know, obviously it's a podcast and nobody could see me, but I feel like standing up and applauding. That is you know, such common sense in that, but it's really, really important.
Yeah, I agree with every word of that paragraph.
Okay, so moving into chapter 5, Michael, if that's okay. We're going to talk about discovery math now. Discovery math, I should say, and how it doesn't add up. So could you just tell us a little bit more about that program and why you feel like that?
Yeah, I mean, discovery math is... people who support it, generally, they don't like that phrase. Sometimes it's called the new math or reform math. Basically, we're talking about math that is taught in a non-direct instruction sort of way, the type of math where students are supposed to are encouraged to discover their own ways of solving questions and such. And so, you know, some of the common math textbooks out here, Math Makes Sense, Math Focus, they take very much this approach. And so you actually don't find in these textbooks the standard algorithms. And standard algorithm, I just simply mean the way that for centuries has been used to do basic adding, subtracting, multiplying, and dividing. And so, for example, with multiplication, the standard algorithm, you put one number on top of the other and then multiply digit by digit and then add it up at the end. If the type of stuff that most people learned how to do if they went to school years ago. And what's happened is that instead of just showing students the most simplest, most efficient way of actually doing the question and getting them to practice it sufficiently so that way it's internalized in their memory, the emphasis is on we want students to think of their own ways of solving it and to be creative and to be flexible and to do mental math and to and what happens is that they don't get a solid grounding of the basics. They don't learn their multiplication times tables that are so essential to higher level math, and they don't learn the most efficient ways of solving the question. And so you end up with students who don't learn math very well, and it shows, particularly when they get to high school, and even more so if they go to math programs at university. The strongest critics of the discovery approach to math are math professors, not just to be clear, not math education professors in faculties of education. That's a totally different breed. Actual mathematicians, real math professors in university, by and large, are some of the strongest proponents of standard algorithms, memorization, and working things step by step, direct instruction, because they know that's what you need to have internalized in your brain in order to be able to do the higher level concepts that you learn university. And so I'm certainly obviously quite critical of discovery math because it's based upon a faulty theory and it just doesn't work that well.
No, absolutely. And in terms of the next chapter, so this is my favorite chapter of the book. And just to remind listeners, so the book is A Sage on the Stage, as we said at the beginning, Common Sense Reflections on Teaching and Learning. And the common sense theme really permeates the book. So in terms of chapter 7, we're going to just do a couple of examples, Michael, if that's okay, about how to improve life for teachers and students. So the first one is, and it's something that's a debate that continues to rage in the UK, why do you feel that it's time to call time on cell phones in school?
Well, it's because they're extremely distracting, and students need to be able to focus. Is so important to learning. You need to have focused attention to something. You need to be able to pay attention, and cell phones are one of the most distracting things out there. And again, there's a difference between moderate levels of distraction. There's a we all have phones these days, and yes, it's true. I'm able to do my work and I have my phone nearby, and sure, I can check a quick message or send in a quick response. If that's all that was happening in class, I actually would go, fine, like let them use their cell phone all they want if that's literally all that was happening. But we know that's not the case. In far too often, students are looking at the phone for extended periods of time, and it's completely distracting them, message after message. And that's just not helpful. I really think that we need to be cutting down on the cell phone use within classrooms, because, and particularly the younger you go. I mean, I'm in the classroom, like I'm practical, I'm a pragmatist, and at high school, I actually do have a little more flexibility in the cell phones. I don't have a total ban, although I am pretty strict. Like, students know that when I'm giving the lesson, I basically tell them, either you put your phone away or I'll put it away. It's better for you to put it away than because I put it away better. You know what I mean? But for younger students, like anything below, like, anything grade 8 and below, the phone shouldn't be anywhere near the classroom. So I'd allow it maybe in a very limited sense at high school just to sort of see if they could be responsible. But anything below, forget it. Like, should a grade 5 student be having a cell phone using in class? No, definitely not.
No. And I mean, in terms of which we referenced, obviously, the pandemic and everything that's going on at the moment, and there's a lot of schools that are looking at sort of reforming policies now in light of current conditions. And, I suppose that as well as the distraction aspect of it, there's a possible, public health and a sanitary aspect to touching phone, touching everything else. So perhaps now, more schools might look at their mobile phone policies or their cell phone policies to see whether, it's something that we could avoid and we don't need anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly does sort of, if it gets us to think about this, and I think that would be great. I mean, I really think that the cell phone use in schools in many cases has gotten out of hand, and the detriments of having too much screen time is well known. And I'd rather err on the side of having too little screen time than too much. I haven't heard of too many people whose learning was sort of stifled because they didn't get enough time on their screen. I actually don't know of anyone in that case, but I can think of plenty where it's the reverse, where they had too much time and it harms their learning. Even something as simple as, I want students to be able to read full books and articles, and when you're just looking at the phone and the screen all the time, you are shortening your attention span. I mean, it's noticeable how attention span has been curtailed because of cell phones and screens. And it's like the number of students who have trouble sort of reading even a sort of a medium length article, never mind a full book. There's just too many distractions out there, and that's problematic.
Absolutely. So into the next way of improving life for teachers and students. I suppose the question here is, would longer days or longer school days make students smarter?
Well, no, there's no evidence that the length of the school day plays a key role in student learning. And I frankly, in terms of how long should the school day be, I'm actually fairly agnostic on this one, because I'm far more concerned with how efficiently are we using the time that we have? And so you could have two schools. You could have school A and school B. And if school A, their day happens to be half an hour shorter than school B, if school A also has fewer assemblies and more direct instruction and better lessons and they're using a better curriculum, I guarantee you that school A will be light years ahead of school B. When governments talk about we're going to improve standards by lengthening the school day, basically that's the government being lazy. They're saying that, we're not going to get to the heart of what's really important. We're just going to, we're just going to sort of propose a policy that's easy for the government to mandate and that looks like we're doing something, but really there's no direct impact. Now, obviously, there is obviously a point where the school day is too short. I'm obviously not interested in saying, oh, it should only be 2 hours a day. Obviously, that's not what I'm talking about. But across most of the world, you know, a school day, we all kind of know what we're talking about. Sort of either 8 or 9 in the morning till about 3 or 4 in the afternoon. This is pretty standard. And whether I frankly don't care if school starts at 8:30 or 8:45 or it ends at 3:30 or 3:15 or 4 or it. That's not the important thing. The important is, what are you doing with the time that you have? Do the best within the time you have. Focus on the things that really matter. And let's not get into big arguments about, are we going to add an extra 15 minutes to every school day to make students learn more?
No, definitely. And the next one, and if you just permit me to do a rather longer setup for this one, so listeners will know that in a previous job, I was in charge of, with the Teacher Development Trust who sponsored the podcast, looking at professional learning programs for schools. And quite often the job involved meeting with a senior leader who was in charge of professional learning and asking them what kind of things they were doing and what kind of things that were coming in from government or from local authority or wherever it might be. And they were drowning in endless initiatives. And, you know, that initial meeting where I said, well, what kind of things are you looking at? Well, we're looking at this program to improve reading. We're looking at this program to improve maths. We're looking at this program to improve retention of teachers. And they just looked physically exhausted. And one of the first things that we said was, right, why are you doing these things? Are they making a difference? And if they're not, you can stop them. And you talk about this, Michael, in the book, how it's valuable sometimes, instead of bringing in a new initiative, to simply stop doing things that aren't working as you improve teacher working conditions by dumping bad ideas. Just tell us a little bit about that.
Well, yeah, it's just amazing how we always seem to add stuff. We always seem to add new programs. You know, there's the new reading program here. There's this new social justice initiative over here. There's this new monitoring thing we're going to do over here, and this new assessment for this, and we never seem to take anything out. And either when we keep adding these things and we never take anything out, do we seriously think that, wow, all these things are so good and so important that we can never take it out because it's just working that well? Because if that was the case, we should be seeing like dramatic improvements in learning, but we don't. Rather, what happens is we see dramatic increases in teacher burnout. And so we need to take a good hard look at some of the initiatives that are being pushed and say, do they actually work? And so you take something like differentiated instruction. This has been pushed, initiated largely by an education professor named Carol Ann Tomlinson. And it's this idea that that we need to, we adapt our teaching to students' learning styles, again, sort of linking in another fad there, and you're basically dividing classes into groups and giving mini lessons to each group, and then giving other students independent work to do. And because then the theory behind it is that you're giving the type of instruction that benefits each of your individual groups. But we never take a step back and go, okay, but how much learning time are we losing? And how much more efficient would it be if we just had teachers just do better whole class instruction? And so instead of having 4 15-minute lessons, you know, where you're repeating the same thing in a slightly different way, how about just one really good 25-minute lesson to everyone, and then give them time to work on it, and then walk up and down the classroom and check to see how their work is going and help the students that need more help? There's just so much that you could drop, so many of these fads and initiatives that you could just drop. And we could put our energies instead into the question of, you know, okay, how do we help students have the most effective classroom management? How do we deal with the behavioral issues? How do we make sure that they're covering the things that we need to cover? And I really get frustrated when I hear about all the initiatives that just keep on getting added because they never get taken away. And I'd like to see at minimum, if we're going to start a new initiative, it has to come at the condition of, okay, we're dropping something of equal, that's an equal amount of work. What are we dropping? I think that would be a good first step in terms of maybe addressing some of that.
Absolutely, it would. And I mean, it's not just external initiatives. I think that, you know, I speak as a senior leader, I think we're also guilty of, you know, we bring in an initiative, say something around behavior, and then we start it in September. By about January, February, we think, okay, we've sorted out behavior. What do we need to do next? And as you say, you move on to assessment, and it's that just let's embed and implement things properly and then reduce the number of different things that we're focusing on before we start throwing more and more things at teachers. Because, you know, too many initiatives and something's got to give. And quite often it can be the quality of teaching in the classroom because teachers are burnt out and exhausted by the endless initiatives that they're asked to do.
Yeah, and it is exhausting, and it frustrates me. I don't want teachers to burn out. Teaching is a challenging enough job without making it worse. And I don't know of any other profession where we just go back and forth in this pendulum, and we just keep adding things, and then, oh, this didn't work. We're now going to do this. So we're going to go back this way. And I don't know of any other profession that operates this way. And, you know, when teachers go to professional development sessions and where they're hearing stuff that, you know, it's yet one more thing they have to do, and what's the research evidence for? Well, you know, that's not for you to worry about. You're just a teacher. Just do what you're told and just implement this stuff. I mean, that's frustrating. I mean, I don't know if other professions where this happens to that degree. I mean, when doctors go to a medical conference, I don't hear too many of them coming back complaining, wow, I can't believe all the stupid stuff that we're being forced to do. Normally they go, oh, there's some good new information here, which we can incorporate into this. And it's just, but education is just, it doesn't have the solid research foundation. We don't rely on the solid research foundation that we have. And instead there seems to be this market for these edu gurus. You make money by making new stuff up, and it always has to be new. And they go around, it's a new book, a new initiative, and so we got to bring them back for another professional development session. And, you know, I'd rather just focus on, hey, actually, there's a good, solid list of things that have been proven to work. Let's focus on getting really good at those and stop bringing in all the new things that don't have the same evidence for them.
Absolutely, and that leads on nicely to the next section about giving teachers a voice in professional development. Now, Tom Bennett has written some praise for Sage on the Stage, as has Paul Kirshner, and they're kind of, Tom's involved in the formation of Research Ed, and Paul often presents at Research Ed as well. So could you just tell listeners a little bit about how you've started to get involved with Research Ed and the sessions that you've led at the Toronto Research Ed Conference?
Yeah, I'm really pleased that Research Ed that Tom Bennett started it, because I first heard about it. I'm trying to think how I first heard about it. It was largely through Dr. Paul Bennett, who's not related to Tom, although kind of the running joke is that, oh, they are. Paul Bennett is a education consultant and former principal here in Canada. And he brought Research Ed to Canada. And so we've had several Research Ed conferences here. And I've had the privilege to attend and present at two of those conferences on the topic of on the importance of content knowledge. And I just have to say that it's so refreshing to go to a conference where you have teachers and educational psychologists and neuroscientists all there together, and even like some regular parents that chose to attend too. And we're looking at the evidence, we're looking at the research. Where you're encouraged to critically examine what you're getting. You can have direct dialogue and even some debate with the presenters. It's just unbelievably intellectually stimulating. And I mean, Tom Bennett, like a great guy. I talked to him a number of times at those sessions. He's doing this because he wants teachers to be able to talk to teachers and to be able to look at the evidence. And he's done a lot of work to get this going, and I'm just pleased that we've had this we've had these type of sessions, because they're just so different from some of the standard professional development that teachers get. One of the Research Ed conferences I was at, Dr. Danny Willingham was the keynote speaker. I mean, he is one of the greatest writers today on how the brain works and how it relates to education. And, you know, if everyone read Why Don't Students Like School, like one of his earlier books on education matters, and if you just read that book and did what's in it, wow, that would improve a lot of things. And so I appreciate Research Ed, and I appreciate what Tom is doing. And when you have experts like Paul Kirshner and others that are there, that are presenting information, I hope it continues to spread and that more teachers get to attend these conferences.
Yep, and again, as listeners will know, you know, we were due to host our very own Research Ed conference, because we, in Blackpool in England, we host one of the Research Ed conferences, and Tom Bennett's been great to come down to that, and obviously some of the presenters that you talked about. So it's a big movement over here as well, and I'm glad to see that it's kind of going further and wider. And they're continuing to do it, Michael, as well. They're continuing to do it from the Research Ed home. So I think that Daniel Willingham has done a session on Research Ed home, and numerous other teachers have done that as well. So we can put some signposts to that in the show notes as well. Michael, I'm so enjoying speaking to you. I've just got one more question, if that's okay.
Sure.
So we've touched on the gadgets in the classroom and the technology, but are gadgets in the classroom just gimmicks, and should technology drive education reform?
Well, technology should never, ever drive education reform. If you're in a school and your school is implementing technology, and now you're designing programs to try to make use of the technology you're implementing, you're doing it all wrong. Bringing technology into the classroom needs to be done in an intentional way, where you have something you're currently doing, and if technology will help you to do that better and make it more efficient, then by all means, technology is great. So, for example, there are schools that have implemented that have given every student a Chromebook at the high school level, where you've sort of got your own mini laptop. When done well, that's not a bad idea for high school students, because now students have a computer that they can type their essays in, and they can look stuff up, and you can put a filter on there and help to keep that focused. For high school, for that type of thing, where, okay, they're going to be typing out essays anyway, now they've all got a little mini computer here that we can use that with, and we can use some class time doing this, and I can now check their work more easily. That's great. That's an example of a good use of technology. Bad use of technology is, hey, we got a donation from this name whatever company here of the 100 iPads, and so we're going to give it to our grade 3 teachers. And so grade 3 teachers, we want you to come up with some ideas about how you're going to use this wonderful donation, and we're going to now focus our learning around it. That's a bad use of technology, and that happens all too often. We should not be – technology should never be the focus of what we're doing. Use it. It's a tool. And, you can just imagine if someone, you would never have someone on a construction site going, we just got a bunch of new tools here. We hadn't planned to do anything with this, but because we've got these new tools, we now need to use them, so we better build this. Like, that's ridiculous. No, you're out there and you're building something and you go, I need this tool in order to build this better, so now I'm going to go use it. That's how we need to look at technology in classrooms.
Absolutely. Well, what a great example there. So I'm just writing that down for future use if I'm ever going to go out and talk about that. That's really good. Michael, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today. Can you just tell us a little bit more about where we can find out more about the book, more about you, and where listeners can get A Sage on the Stage? And if they're interested in going further, they can go and have a look at your book that you co-authored, which is What's Wrong with Our Schools and How We Can Fix Them.
Well, sure. I mean, the book is called A Sage on the Stage, Common Sense Reflections on Teaching and Learning. And it's published by John Catt Education, and John Catt Education is a great publisher. They publish a lot of books on for teachers that have some great that information for them. So, I mean, one place you could go to find out more about the book is you go to the John Catt website, and it's prominently positioned there. You could also find my book on Amazon. Whichever Amazon, whether it's in the UK or the US or in Canada, The Sage and the Stage can be ordered through Amazon or through major booksellers. If you go online, you can put in a request and you can access it. You can access it through there. To find out more about me, I do have a website at michaelzwagstra.com, and it's Michael with A-E-L and then Zwagstra, Z-W-A-A-G-S-T-R-A, and that's .com. And I believe in the UK you have Z and not Z like me, so that's great. I don't have to be. and then also on Twitter, I'm fairly active on Twitter. If you want to follow me there, Zwagstra M is my hashtag. Is my Twitter handle. Gotta use my terminology right. So Zwagstra M, Zwaagstra, and then M, and then you do a search for me, and you can follow me on there and Twitter is where I'll often put up commentary and things. I'll often put links to some of the articles I publish there as well. So either my website or my Twitter. And then if you want the book, which you either go to Amazon or go to John Catt directly, and you can order the book.
Excellent. And we are very fortunate to be sponsored by John Catt on the podcast. So we will direct listeners to be able to go and find the book, definitely. So thank you again, Michael, for your time. Really, really appreciate it, and great to speak to you. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Phil. I've enjoyed this, and I appreciate the discussion. So thanks so much for having me on.
Nailers Netter, just talking to teachers.
Podcast pedagogy. What is Phil reading this week? Podcast pedagogy. Listening to teachers.
Nailers Netter, just talking to teachers.
This week on Podcast Pedagogy, I am reading the Research Ed Guide to the Curriculum, an evidence-informed guide for teachers, which is part of John Catt's Research Ed series. And this book is edited by Claire Seely, and the series editor is Tom Bennett. For listeners that are not aware, Research Ed is an educator-led organisation with the goal of bridging the gap between research and practice. So this is a very accessible and punchy series, which is overseen by founder Tom Bennett, and it tackles the most important topics in education with a wide range of experienced contributors exploring the latest evidence and research and how it can apply in a variety of classroom settings. So in this book, Claire Seely explores how schools can get the most out of a rich curriculum, and she edits contributions from a wide range of writers, including previous guests. So we've got Neil Almond, who did a podcast with us, Doug Lamov, and we've got Doug Lamov's with Emily Badillo, we've got Sonia Thompson, Christine Council, Professor Michael Young, again, who did a podcast with us on powerful knowledge, Ruth Ashby, who also did a podcast with us on powerful knowledge as well, and Aurora Reed. And for listeners, Claire Seely, we're well known to you, and Claire is a guest on the podcast coming up. So I recorded an interview with Claire this week, and it's fantastic. So Claire spent 30 years as a primary school teacher, and 22 of them as a head teacher, and she worked in Tower Hamlets in the East End of London. She has recently left headship to become head of curriculum and standards for the state of Guernsey, and she blogs about how her school put educational research findings into practice, and her hugely popular blog is primarytimery.com. Her particular interests are the application of cognitive science in the classroom and curriculum development, and obviously she explores that in this book. So if you're interested in this book, we'll be a podcast about it in the next couple of weeks, but if you want to go and get that, it's available on the John Catt website. So that's the Research Ed Guide to the Curriculum, an evidence-informed guide for teachers, and that's what I'm reading this week.
Nailers Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA1977 on Twitter.
Nailers Netter, just talking to teachers.